it's inexcusable for you as a founder, salesperson, not to spend 10 minutes of time on my website and look to see what I'm carrying, go to my Instacart, make up a basket, look at your competitors in the space that you're selling. Are they there? If they're not there, that's probably a red flag that maybe they don't carry those products. But look and see, how does the, look at their socials. What are they posting on Facebook? Are they using TikTok? Are they using Instagram? You got $100,000 to spend. Okay, I'm sitting down now with my category manager. Tell me, I've looked at this and this. How do I invest the money? Is it demos? Is it promos? Is it ads? Is it off shelf? Is it Instagram? What is going to help me drive volume there? Asking those questions and doing your homework before asking those questions, it'll be very beneficial.
Welcome to the Seven Hats Podcast. My name is Yuval Selig, and I've been on the entrepreneurial roller coaster for over 20 years. I've experienced it all throughout my journey: the grind, burnout, failure, and ultimately, success. The turning point for me was realizing that building a successful company is meaningless if you neglect the other significant areas of your life. So today, I'm inviting you to join me on an adventure through those seven areas, what I call the seven hats. Every week, my guests and I will drop valuable insights and pearls of wisdom, helping, motivating, and inspiring you to get your seven hats in order and deliver real impact with meaning. So let's get going. Hey there, Seven Hatters. Today, we're diving into the fascinating world of consumer packaged goods, CPG, with Wade Yenny, a seasoned industry expert who's held major roles at Bueller's, Jimbo's, and The Fresh Market. In this episode, we're focusing on hats 1, 3, and 4, the soul, the servant, and the entrepreneur, as we explore Wade's incredible journey from his early days in Ohio to becoming a key figure in the CPG buyer world. Wade's story is all about resilience, overcoming personal and professional challenges, and building genuine relationships. We'll explore his unique experiences and insider tips on what brands need to do to get on the shelf and stay on the shelf, how he maintains mental health in such high-pressure roles, and his leadership philosophy. So if you're curious about the behind-the-scenes action in the CPG industry, want to learn from an experienced pro, or just love hearing about perseverance and growth, well, sit back and let's warmly welcome Wade to the Seven Hats. Wade, welcome to the Seven Hats.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Appreciate you having me.
Well, listen, I'm genuinely thrilled to have you here today. And honestly, for a couple of really great reasons, I think. First off, I just think that you're an awesome person and I'm lucky to call you a friend. Second, you're a powerhouse in a world that I care deeply about, the world of CPG, and that's consumer packaged goods for those who might not know. You've made a huge impact in the natural and organic grocery sector, truly a grocery innovator with a heart. You've shaped experiences at some of my favorite places. Back when I was in California, Jimbo's and The Fresh Market. And if that's not impressive enough, you're also a LinkedIn legend, about to step into a new adventure, which we're going to be unpacking. All of that and more today. But before we begin, the Seven Hatters, as we call them, our audience, are really interested to hear about your path into the CPG world right from the start, before anyone had a chance to warn you about it. Just kidding, of course. So, Wade, let's rewind to the beginning where it all started. Where were you born and how was your childhood like?
Well, first of all, thank you for all the kind words. I think you probably set the bar higher than I'll ever get to, but I appreciate it nonetheless, and I'm happy and blessed to call you a friend as well. But okay, where was I born? I was born in Ohio, in a little town. The actual birthplace that I was born, not where I lived, but where I was born, is called Maslin, Ohio. And born to my father was actually born in Switzerland.
Oh, wow.
Came over shortly after, I think, his first birthday or second. His father had come over to kind of lay the groundwork to bring his family over, and my father and grandmother came over thereafter. My father had worked for his father in a glass and mirror and paint business. So I think that's part of where my entrepreneurial vision comes from, is just that my dad, for the entire time he was with us, owned his own business and operated his own business. You know, he was the only employee. He'd have some spare hands help him with larger jobs, but he did that himself. And the other thing that's probably relative to, and I'm sure we'll probably get into this a little bit, is that I was born in July, and August after my first birthday, my mother passed away from cancer. So when you ask about my upbringing, I think there's a large portion of who I am and what I came to be from that upbringing, specifically my father, raising myself, my younger sister, older than me, but younger than my older sister. That's probably not the best way to phrase that, but raising us essentially by himself. So yeah, we could probably go from there and dive into it, but that's where I was born and kind of laying the groundwork for probably a little bit more for us to talk about.
So interesting. Your father, who raised you, obviously had never met your mom. Mm-hmm. Did he remarry? Was there another mom figure in the family?
He technically on paper remarried, but I would call it more of a business arrangement for housekeeping and things like that. And that was for a brief period of time. By the time I was out of elementary school, that was over. So for the most part, I would say, if I'm asked, I would say he essentially raised me by himself and really didn't have what I would call a mother figure in the picture as far as when I was growing up.
Grandma, grandparents?
No, and that's the other interesting part. So when I was born, my father was 46.
Oh, wow.
So he had me late in life. So all my grandparents, both paternal and maternal, passed away before 1980. So met all but one of them. My paternal grandfather passed away before I was born, but the other three were gone before I was, I don't know, 6 or 8 years old.
So take me through the life of a young kid, a sister, a father. You had the father figure, energetic upbringing, which is great because mm-hmm. I'm sure you've learned a lot from your dad. Looking back, what do you think not having a feminine figure in your life, how did that affect your upbringing and your adulthood?
I think, you know, my dad being his age and coming from the background he came from was very male focused. You know, the women were the nurturers, the caregivers, and, you know, the taking care of the home. And that had to quickly change after my mother passed away. You know, and I think so that original relationship, that business aspect, I told, you know, was there kind of maybe to set the foundation. But then after she left, it was, you know, it was the three of us kind of fending for ourselves from a standpoint of, you know, cooking and cleaning and doing the dishes and laundry, everything. You know, so I think that probably was a pretty significant impact just simply because, you know, those things that typically, you know, stereotypically, I should say, a mother does for a child, I didn't have. So, you know, we either did them ourselves or, you know, my father. So I think that from an early age, I realized that, you know, my opinion is that, you know, this isn't her job or his job, it's our job, you know.
Yeah, and so I think that's,
yeah, exactly.
For me, I'm a foodie and obviously a home amateur cook, and the reason is because my parents both worked so much when I was growing up that at 12 I actually had to start cooking, otherwise I'd be dead. So I had to figure it out. Was that your life too, in terms of, are you an avid cook because of that upbringing? Or
I would say more so for the next progression in high school. I as soon as I was old enough to get a job, I started working as a cook at a family restaurant, you know, a chain restaurant, Big Boy, you know, if you're familiar.
Yeah, of course.
But I started that in high school. So kind of already had the background from having to do it a little bit at home, but then, you know, doing it for money and for a job through high school and then later on certainly contributed to that foodie aspect as far as learning, wanting to play with foods. You know, obviously you had the menu and what was on it, but, you know, constantly looking to, okay, what can I do with this? If I take this off and add this or, you know, do something different, definitely influenced me.
So take me through your formable year. So you're in high school. Mm-hmm. What was the dream? What did you want to do? And what did your father want you to do at that point?
I think my father was open. I think, you know, certainly if he wrote the book, he probably would have liked me to go and follow in his footsteps, his father's footsteps, take over the family business, which was a glass and mirror company. They dropped the paint after a fire. So shied away from selling paint and only did glass and mirrors and installations, custom, you know, cutting and things like that. And just while I appreciated the upbringing and in the life it provided for our family, it just didn't interest me. I'm not a very mechanical guy. I'm not, you know, if you know, something needs done on my car, I'm probably going to pay someone to do it. I'm not going to try and do it myself. I'm just always been one of those people that's like, okay, there's experts that do things and there's people that tinker around with things and maybe do it halfway like they should. I'd rather pay and get it done right the first time. If you asked me in high school, I probably would have said I either wanted to be a lawyer or go into communications of some kind, you know, as far as doing what with that, I don't know. But, you know, I started the job cooking and life just went a different direction from there, you know, as far as what I wanted to do or thought I wanted to do versus what I ended up doing, I guess, are two different things.
That's amazing. So you graduate high school. Did you go to college? What happened after high school?
Yeah. So it's probably a larger story, but my girlfriend in high school was a year younger than me. And so I had the brilliant plan that I would stay home. I was accepted to college, was ready to go. Thought, well, I'll just stay home a year and wait until she goes to college and we'll go. And of course, we know how that story ends. So when people ask me about college, what I tell them is that I had my own restaurant for a few years. That was probably more costly than college education. It probably taught me a lot more about life and business than a college education could have. But no, so I went straight from high school. I kept working. Shortly after graduating high school, I went from being that cook, you know, in that family restaurant to being a salaried assistant manager of that restaurant. So very quickly, you know, from an hourly work rate to a 50-hour a week salaried management. So I've literally been a salaried manager of one kind or another for over 40 years. Or no, I'm sorry. Jeez, I just gave age myself 10 years, over 30 years. So yeah, in one form or another.
And so what happened after the restaurant? Walk me through the buyer experience.
Yeah, I was going to say, so it's another restaurant step or two before I got to the buyer aspect. So I was the cook for the family restaurant, assistant manager, left there and worked for an independent restaurant as the manager for them. And about 10 months into that relationship, the owners were two sisters and they decided that they wanted to spend more time with their families. And I got the bright idea that I could at that young age, I have to do the math. I think I was 22, 24, somewhere in that range, that I could be the owner of the restaurant. And went in with a buddy, a partner, kind of, you know, we would be the two people taking the place of the two sisters and did it that way. Had a decent business, but at that time, the more important part of that story is before I took that position at that family restaurant or the independent restaurant, I interviewed for a company called Bueller's in Ohio. And they offered me a position as well as this independent family restaurant, but a restaurant position for Bueller's. I politely declined. They offered me a hourly manager training position, and I had been a salaried manager, so I thought that was kind of not a slap in the face, but it was kind of, no thank you. So I went the other route. So when we closed the restaurant, after I took over as owner, I made a call to Bueller's, and the person that offered me that position answered the phone and offered me a new position as a salaried manager. And so I went to work for Bueller's and their restaurants. Bueller's is at the time was 13 store family owned grocery chain that had full service restaurants. So I went to work for them in the capacity of a restaurant food service manager and quickly learned that if I wanted to move up in the company, I should learn the grocery business because they were grocery stores that had restaurants, not restaurants that had grocery stores. So expressed my interest to learn the grocery business. I was moved from the restaurant into a training program to be a salaried grocery manager. Spent a year traveling to all the locations in the company, learning everything about grocery, receiving, dairy, frozen, bread, cashier, night stock, you name it. I did it for that year, traveling to all the locations, and then was placed as the salaried grocery manager at our Wadsworth location, which was the busiest grocery department at that time, and did that for about 2 years before I applied for the corporate buying job at the main office about 2 years after that. So, and that's how I ended up in the buying side.
One of the reasons I was really excited to interview you was because of my experience in CPG being a brand founder. And as a brand founder, we hyper-focus on our brand, manufacturing, getting the product out there, and getting on shelf. But it's a one-sided vision because we only look at it from our standpoint. And I'm sure there are a lot of listeners thinking about potentially creating a product, launching a product, getting on shelf, or even staying on shelf. And I thought your perspective is going to be an interesting opportunity for them to see it from the other side of the business, because there's always two sides to the coin. So as a buyer, because I want to tap into a little bit of that experience, but give the audience who are not really aware of what a buyer does, what their responsibilities are, from a buyer's perspective, what is a day in life?
I think a lot of it depends on your organization. And so the other thing that I would say is buyer, by definition, depends on the organization that you're with. A buyer can simply be at a larger organization like a distributor, so could just be writing POs and worried about fulfillment. My experience with a buyer everywhere I've been, or category managers, they're often called as well, they wear not seven hats, they might wear 107 hats. Any given day, you could be talking about promotions, you could be talking about assortment, you could be talking about problems with supply chain, you could be talking about ordering, store-related issues. I mean, truly a number of different things. And I think for me, one of the challenging aspects of the role was to connect with people like yourself or a founder of a brand or a broker for that matter, and kind of get the understanding that, hey, I don't just have your brand. I just don't have your items. I have, in the case of Buehler's, I had everything in grocery, dairy, frozen, plus our warehouse facility. So I could go in any given day and talk about my first appointment of cigarettes, to breakfast cereal, to eggs, to DSD milk, to ice cream, to frozen pizza, and everywhere in between. And so trying to, I guess what I'm getting at is, for me, it's so many times, I hear brands or I hear brokers or someone, oh, I didn't get a response from the buyer, I didn't get a response. There's a reason for that. And it's not negligence. It's probably they're trying to put out three or four other fires because they do so many different things. And I think that awareness and a little empathy probably goes a long way in understanding that relationship.
Every CPG founder or expert that was on my show, I ask a simple question. What would you recommend to young CPG entrepreneurs who want to get in the business? And unanimously, they all say the same thing. They say, don't do it. And I wouldn't say don't do it, but be warned. The journey is a tough journey. Your interaction with a buyer is a one-to-one relationship. Your interaction then with the shopper is a one-to-many relationship. And so your product could be a great product or even not so great of a product, and you're just a really great salesperson and you convince the buyer to bring them in, but then that's getting on the shelf. And then staying on the shelf requires a whole other type of experience. So as a buyer, the one thing that I want to dive deep into, which I don't know if you've had this question or not, but it would be interesting to get your take on it. From an emotional standpoint, okay, you've had, or you have as a buyer, a significant influence on which brands make it onto the shelf, which brands stay on the shelf. And I think that's a pretty heavy load to take on, especially if you get to know some of these founders. Do you have any memorable stories from your career that stuck with you about these types of experience, about getting on the shelf, staying on the shelf, and your connection with one or another memorable brand?
I would think of two examples. One is not so much a brand, but it's a private label example of sourcing our private label coffee program in Ohio, and was fortunate to find what I would call local, reasonably within an hour or so of our office, family-owned business, father and I think three sons running it. And I just remember going up to that facility for the first time and just seeing, having that family, that just that closeness, and just as opposed to a corporate type DSD program from a big place that was three or four states away, having someone local in our backyard that was roasting coffee, the quality, the care they took in the relationship, and just really set the groundwork. And it's interesting because, I left Buehler's about five, six years ago. And I saw recently on their social media that supplier that I brought in all those years ago. I'm going to date myself. I don't know if it's 20. They just celebrated an achievement of some kind, whether it was so many years or being awarded Supplier of the Year or something like that. So it's almost like being able to connect with that and say, you know, hey, I played a part in that, of introducing that relationship, starting that relationship, building it, and now it's still growing. And so I liken that same example to so many of the brands that I met when I was in California, because I was dealing with, you know, different than a Buehler's or Rouse's, who I haven't really talked about yet, but that you're dealing with the emerging brands that maybe they don't have a sales team yet, or the founder is the sales team. And really being able to develop those relationships with people that are so passionate about their products. And the one that comes to mind is, you know, and it sounds probably silly because of how big they are now, but Midday Squares. I think I was, you know, at Jimbo's, I was either the second or third retailer in the country to bring them in. And that relationship started between Jake and I on LinkedIn, me reaching out to him and saying, hey, I like what you guys are doing. We should talk and set up a meeting. And, you know, he's someone that I consider a friend to this day, you know, and, you know, but that relationship started on a LinkedIn message. He visited me, spent time in my home in California, spent time at Jimbo's, filming videos back and forth. I mean, it's really, again, to see where they were, where they are, where they're going. It's almost like a parent type relationship from a standpoint of, you know, I feel this way about so many people I've worked with over the years in the stores as well as the offices that I've been in. When people underneath you grow, it's like a proud moment for you to watch that growth. And hopefully at some point they surpass you. And with a brand perspective, it's kind of the same thing as, you know, you want to see them grow within your realm and your scope. But then watching them continue to grow outside of that, it's just, you can say, oh yeah, I remember when, that sort of thing. It's kind of cool.
Tell me that there's video of you and Jake dancing, please.
I don't know about dancing. I know there's video. I think the last time he was down, we played ping pong at a brewery. So I don't know if there's video of that or not, but we've had some good times for sure. You know, and what I love about the relationship is it is genuine, and it's fun to, you know, he spent time stopping at the various places I've been in North Carolina and California and making the time to connect and build that relationship. So regardless of what you see on the camera and whatnot, there is a lot of genuine quality behind that. You know, it's very, very meaningful. So
Jake is an incredible human being. All three of the founders are incredible, but Jake and I had a wonderful conversation on a previous show. So look that up. He's very entertaining and passionate, and probably one of the most honest entrepreneurs I've ever encountered. So I think when you have this, and I want to continue digging a little bit into the mindset of that buyer, founder, or brand relationship. So I think a lot of founders don't really appreciate the pressures that buyers face, right? When introducing a new brand to limited shelf space. This is not Amazon. You only have a certain amount of shelf space, which often involves kicking somebody out, right? When somebody else comes in. Can you describe that decision-making process, and what tips do you have for founders who are looking to stay, even if they're potentially underperforming? And what is a game stopper for you having as a buyer to kick them out, no matter how much you love them as a brand?
Yeah. So that's, again, obviously the scope of the organization depends a lot on to answer that question, but I'll try and do the best I can with a couple examples. So when you look at some place like Jimbo's, for example, large store, high volume, you know, their set sizes, they don't have to, aside from their ingredient standards and making sure the products fit and meet those standards, they have a lot more freedom to bring more products in just because of the size and scope of their business. Whereas you look at the Fresh Market, where I just finished up at 160 stores, 22 states. And so when you're making a decision to put something on the shelf, lot smaller set sizes, store volumes vary from, you know, I don't want to say ABCD, whatever, just varying, you know, from a lower volume to a very, very high volume. So you're making decisions there that are way more data-based, way more calculated with regards to what is the item performance for that space on the shelf and does it deserve it? So to answer your question, when I'm reviewing a product that, like, for example, like Jimbo's, I'm looking at how is it selling, performed against something else. Probably going to do everything in my power to help the brand succeed because of the small, intimate environment, 4 stores, yada, yada. And then also not really going to be concerned with overall velocity as much, provided that I'm not spoiling a lot of, you know, if I'm throwing product out, that's all bets are off, you know, if, you know, outside of extenuating circumstances. But someplace where we're doing the fresh market, doing a formal category review, and making decisions, the data speaks for itself. You're looking at the data in the market, what's performing, what isn't performing, the brand that you're looking at potentially dropping, how is it doing overall? So is it negligence or mismanagement with the brand and or you on this side? Or if it's down 20, 30% of the market everywhere, maybe there's a story there. You know, so looking at things that way. As far as reaching, you know, as far as what advice I would give, I would say just to know your numbers. You know, you should have full visibility into how a product, your product's performing in the retailer that you're being evaluated at. And I wouldn't wait for the category review period to dive into that. You know, it's probably too late at that point. In other words, if I put you on the shelf today, I'd want to see how I'm doing in 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, so on monthly, you know, and to stay on top of it so that if there is a problem, if we need to kick in an extra promotion or do something outside the norm to keep that volume up, I'm doing that proactively, not waiting for 9 months, 10 months when the review's coming up, the data's already there and it's not there, you know? And so a decision has to be made, but that's, I don't know if I answered the question or we can dig into it a little bit more.
I think the problem with a lot of the, cause I'm in the trade spend world and a lot of the issues that brands might have, especially with indirect stores. If you're direct, you can follow the numbers because you know what the shipments are, the actual shipments. If you're in Sprouts, as an example, and you can't afford spins data, right? How do you get the numbers? Do you call the buyer and ask for insight about specific stores? What kind of advantage does a brand have, or at least an opportunity that they have to, because I agree with you. I think many brands get on the shelf and then they hope and pray, and we'll talk about trade spend in a second, whether it's worth it or not, but they spend a bunch of money and they don't know what's going on because they don't have the real numbers to back it up and the financial ability, or at least the analytical ability to understand how they're performing. So what do you recommend in those situations, and how much does the buyer have in terms of power to deliver the information to the brand?
Good question. So obviously the easy answer is spins, but you preface that by saying if you can't afford spins. So we'll address that. I can tell you it really, again, a lot of it's dependent on the retailer. I can tell you that there was a period of time in Ohio where we were very reluctant, hesitant, or defiant to share numbers. You know, we would share units, but we didn't share margins. We didn't share, you know, dollars or anything like that. It was just simply units. And it was relative to your products only, not, you know, but again, that was under a leadership that's what they wanted. And so you abided by those rules. I think for the space we're talking about, emerging brands, I think especially ones that are getting in, you know, some of the retailers you mentioned, I'm assuming there's a relationship that's been, you know, started with regards to the buyer, the category manager, whoever's. And so I think if I'm an emerging brand in the space and I'm looking to take on an account like a Sprouts or a fresh or larger size account, I'm probably going to be as transparent as I can be up front, simply to say, you know, can you, you know, what you ask those questions, what can you provide me, you know, up front of before I sign off to say, yes, I want to be in 400 stores. Because I always say that the easy part is getting on the shelf. That's the easy part. You know, I can put something on the shelf. You send me samples. I can walk in any gas station and just throw something on a shelf. That's easy, right?
Yep.
It's getting it off the shelf into customers' baskets and then reorders, et cetera. That's where it gets difficult. And I think for me, the more transparent and just open about what your needs are from a brand perspective, if you're upfront and honest with those, I don't see any reason why you wouldn't share that. So for example, Jimbo's, I had an account, a brand that was very regular in reaching out to ask about how's this doing, you know, as far as, you know, when we ran a promotion, and it would ask the questions. Now, if that was every week, I'd probably get a little annoyed because of all the other duties I was talking about, but he had built that relationship, and I knew up front that he was going to ask that. So I was prepared whenever the promotion came about. I mean, the other thing that, and again, I'm sure we're going to talk about this a little bit, but is obviously if you do scan-based promos, you're going to see your numbers because you're going to see
deduction,
what goes through the register versus an off invoice or an MCB or something where you don't have that quite that visibility. So, and I know some retailers are more receptive to scan based than others, but that's an option to obviously on promo to see how things are doing.
What you said was really interesting, and I agree. I think you got to know your numbers, as Mr. Wonderful says on Shark Tank. But one of the suggestions that I provide to folks that I speak with who are founders or just getting started, I always tell them to not only get to know the buyer on a friendly level as best as possible, because sometimes it's impossible, but there are times that it is a feasible opportunity. But be upfront with them and let them know how much money you really have in the bank and what it's going to take for you to stay on the shelf. So, hey, Wade, I'm a startup. I didn't raise any funds. I have a few $100,000 in the bank, and I really want to succeed in your retail outlet. What do you recommend? What's the velocity that I need to hit? And based on your experience, Wade, what do I need to do to get there? And do you recommend something like that? Have you seen brands that do work in this fashion succeed more than brands that just put the product on the shelf and forget about it?
I don't know that anyone's laid it out how you just said it, but I would say people that follow that roadmap or a similar roadmap, absolutely. From a standpoint of, you know, and I encourage this, you know, whatever platform I'm on, whether it's our podcast or, you know, conversationally when I'm talking to people, I encourage this all the time, is to be retailer specific with regards to promotions and understanding what drives volume at that account. You know, like speaking for this retailer, maybe it is it a published weekly flyer? Is it a, you know, is it a email? Is it Instagram? What is driving volume at that store? But before that, before you even get into that store, you should, I think one of the biggest mistakes people make is not having familiarity with the stores that they're trying to get their product in. So for example, the Fresh Market, we eliminated vitamins, mineral supplements about 6 months ago, give or take. Up till I left, we're still having people pitch us on, you know, and without the knowledge that that product isn't even in the stores and hasn't been. So I say that because in this day and age, I say this all the time, it's inexcusable for you as a founder, salesperson, not to spend 10 minutes of time on my website and look to see what I'm carrying, go to my Instacart, make up a basket, look at your competitors in the space that you're selling. Are they there? If they're not there, that's probably a red flag that maybe they don't carry those products. But look and see look at their socials. What are they posting on Facebook? Are they using TikTok? Are they using Instagram? Really dive into how, to your point, you've got $100,000 to spend. Okay, I'm sitting down now with my category manager. Tell me, I've looked at this and this. How do I invest the money? Is it demos? Is it promos? Is it ads? Is it off shelf? Is it Instagram? What is going to help me drive volume there? And I feel like, you know, asking those questions and doing your homework before asking those questions, it'll be very beneficial.
Yeah, I think if you want to be successful in CPG, and you tell me what you think, number one, don't grow too fast, depending on how much cash you have. Stay within a local area. Flood that local area with as much support to the retailer as you can. Train the store staff as often as you can. Give them the product sample so they can use it, because that demo after the demo is really important. Store staff get asked all the time for recommendations. And if they love you and they love your product, I'm sure that Jake was successful with many of the retailers because of that relationship, because of the samples that he provided and the support that he provided initially. In terms of trade spend, it's really difficult. I've seen folks spend a lot of money on trade spend and it didn't work at all. And I've seen folks spend a lot of money and it worked really well. So you really, again, have to know your numbers. Wait, do you agree with that sentiment in terms of growth for a smaller brand?
Absolutely. Yep.
Okay. In terms of your role as a buyer, at least where you worked, did you have the opportunity to be entrepreneurial, or was it more of a corporate setting?
In certain roles, I would say it was entrepreneurial, and my most recent role was definitely more corporate, obviously, the size and scope of the organization. But at Jimbo's, I would say most likely I had an entrepreneurial spirit from a standpoint of connecting with the founders and just really so many times Jimbo's, Erewhon, we all know the names out there, you know, Bristol Farms, of those accounts that, you know, it's kind of like, you know, putting your flag in the ground. Once you, oh, I landed Jimbo's, I've got Erewhon, I've got Mother's, I've got Gelson's, you know, and so on and so forth. So I think it was, you were along for that ride. I was, as far as being a buyer, director, whatever title I had, you know, working with brands, getting them on shelf. But it was kind of like you felt that it was almost like a joint venture, especially for brands that you were first to market or one of the first to markets with.
And you had a team, right, that you worked with?
Depends. I always had a team of some kind, but depending on, again, what stop you're talking about on the journey, the size of the team varied. You know, Jimbo's obviously very small team. We had an assistant that we shared amongst all the buyers. I had one other buyer, dairy frozen buyer, and then I had a merchandiser in stores, and that was it. So just very tight team as far as, you know, accountability and, you know, but along with that comes the opportunity to build tight relationships, right? And so that's important.
And so with a team, do you need to have a consensus of bringing a product in, or is it just you that makes that decision?
I think it's depending on the individuals, it can be a little bit of both. You know, if we were on the fence about something, you might ask the other one, say, hey, you know, because let's be honest, I'm anything but a vegan or vegetarian. I like protein. I'm not afraid to admit it. But so if you bring me something that maybe isn't in my wheelhouse, like, you know, the latest tofu or something like that,
yeah,
I might not make the decision based on, you know, I always say to speak with this and not this, just because I like it doesn't mean thousands of other people will like it. So if we're on the fence on something, or if there is something that, you know, maybe we felt we needed to collaborate on, we certainly would. But then also I'm a firm believer in empowering your team to make decisions. And so, you know, if there's some no-brainers out there, I'm anything but a micromanager, you know, so it's like, yeah, run with it. What are you waiting for me for? You know, it's good, go, you know? And so, you know, that's one of the things as larger organizations, when you're working with more people, you got to trust those people, and you put them in spots, and they're getting paychecks, right? And benefits and all these things. Let them do their job. You know, don't micromanage it, you know, coach them, mentor them, you know, guide them, but let them do their job, you know? And I've said it time and time again, this team at the Fresh Market that I just finished up with, fabulous team, awesome instincts. I just sit back and let them do their thing. You know, it was one of the things I told them in my closing, you know, email that I sent the group. It was like, you know, you made me look good. You know, it's like, don't underestimate what you're, you know, and have that self-confidence that you can do it. So
I love that. And that's a great leadership lesson to the seven headers here, because as a leader, number one, you don't want to be the smartest person in the room. And number two, because you shouldn't be the smartest person in the room, you should allow others to do their job, do it well, and they're just going to make you look good. So I think that's a perfect leadership lesson here. If those didn't catch it, that's your tidbit. Roll back.
So I was going to say, someone told me a long time ago, if you want to be promoted, the best thing you can do is to train your replacement. Meaning, you know, exactly. You don't want to leave you know, build your team up so that you can move on to bigger and better things. And I'm proud to say that every stop that I've made, you know, when I've left, I feel like I've left at a better place than when I got there. But secondly to that, more often than not, the people underneath me received some kind of promotion after I left to fill the void. And I think that speaks volumes about building people and building teams.
100%. Let's switch gears a little bit to mental health. I've been hearing you and others speak so much about a problem that I haven't really seen much when I was growing up, but maybe it was because social media was not around and the information was not going out to everyone as quickly as it is today. But mental health is a really big issue right now, as for entrepreneurs, and I think for others in roles like you had, right? Because you had a bullseye in your head and it was a really high pressure role. You make a couple of mistakes, it's your job on the line. How did you, throughout your buying experience with the different organizations, because some of them were more entrepreneurial, some of them were more corporate, how did you stay connected to your core values, right? And potentially speak to some of the mental health challenges the results from this type of environment when it's really high pressure to make the right decision and to succeed?
Yeah. So I think, you know, for me, I've always been a big tech guy. I've always been, you know, like growing up, I was big into video games and all those things. And as we've advanced, we had kids and whatnot. My goal was always to stay one step ahead of them. As you know, if Snapchat was the latest and greatest, I need to know how to use that and so on and so forth. So I key that up to kind of go into to answer the question. So mental health for me, I think at times I absolutely focus more on my job than I did myself and my family. And, you know, like whether that pertains to answering an email on your phone at 9 o'clock at night or 5 o'clock in the morning before you leave the house or, you know, and really, so the struggle with me often was self-inflicted. I wouldn't say that I'm a workaholic, but I could, you know, I was absolutely obsessive over taking great pride in responding to emails quickly just because it you know, talk about core values. It's, you know, that's how I want to be treated. I always feel like treat people the way you want to be treated. So if I have a question, I need an answer. I'd like it to get answered quickly. So I always felt that was something, you know, so I was constantly, you know, taking calls, doing emails and things, you know, all hours, you know, before work, after work, at the detriment of things, you know, obviously. And I think that as I progressed through my career, I'd like to say, I backed off a little bit off that. I don't know that I actually did. What I would say is that my outlook on work, if you asked Wade day one, buy a role in Ohio in 2005, whatever year it was, my attitude was definitely more us versus them, buyers versus, you know, brands. And, you know, my job was to get as much money out of you as I could. And I wanted to, you know, and I don't care what it costs you. And, you know, it's just, oh, I got this deal and we're going to make 75% gross, whatever it was, right? Uh-huh. And I can tell you, Today and now, it's a lot different simply because I'd like to say I've grown wiser with age, but we're in it together, right? We complicate things in this business. It's all about selling more product, selling more stuff. Doesn't matter what it is. That's what we want to do. But mental health for me, I think, you know, is part of this process that I'm on currently. You know, it's certainly what I've said publicly, openly, and will continue to say is that certainly something that I'm going to focus on in my next role. You know, these 3 weeks, this 2.5 weeks I've been technically unemployed here, you know, have been great from reconnecting with myself. You know, I've gone on, you know, I've averaged 40, 50 miles a week walking, you know, going out for a walk first thing in the morning before the sun comes up, going out at lunchtime, sometimes going back out in the evening, but just really focusing on and being like, oh yeah, this is important. You know, it's not all money. It's not all, you know, promoting and getting higher up the corporate chain. It's, you know, there's a, that factor that you have to think about. And I got to let you talk here for a second. But one thing I'll say is a mentor of mine, I don't know if you know Steve Black, but he was a president of Rouse's when I was there and remains a great friend of this day. But he gives the example of having the towel by, you know, by at home, your personal and your work. And so when you leave work, you wash your hands, you leave it all there, you go home and you be present, right? And when you leave home, you wash your hands of all whatever's going on with the kids and family and whatnot, and you go to work and you give 100%. And I think it's just a great example of being able to think about things that way, is saying, okay, you know, I'm here, I got to be here now. I'm there, I got to be there now. And this will all come around. So
you really are speaking the truth. I speak with so many that after so many years of grinding and just focusing on work, they figured that the rest of their life is kind of screwed up as a result. And I think it's like that for any, that's why the seven hats exist, because no matter what part of your life that you obsess about, it will ultimately destroy that you obsess about. If you focus on business and you neglect your relationships, your health, your mindset, your mental health, you ultimately can't succeed in the business. So whatever you're focusing on, you're actually damaging by just focusing fully on it. And the same thing, if you're working out, you're just constantly working out and it's all you're doing, right? Then your body's going to fail in you eventually because you're not giving it the rest, the relaxation, the mental, you know, fortitude to get better. So I think that's a really good lesson. Just want to shift to where you are right now, but also how I met you. You became involved and served as an influencer and a thought leader on LinkedIn for a good number of months, years now. What happened? How did you become involved and what I call all in? And what has the platform done for you, for your career? And then after you answer that, I want to talk about Alex. So I'll get to Alex in a second. But how did you get involved initially before you met Alex on LinkedIn?
Yeah. So I joined LinkedIn when I was in Ohio as a way to connect with people. And I think, you know, back then it was just, you know, oh, I'm connected and didn't post anything. Every once in a while, someone would give me a, I don't know, a thumbs up, whatever, for inventory management or something like that. That's all it was to me, right? And then moved to Louisiana and used it a little bit more there. Again, I wasn't really posting a lot, but I was using a little bit more there. I think for me, where I dove in 100% is when I took the role in California. So I went to Jimbo's. We moved in June of 2020, which we all know what that was. That's the middle of COVID. And so here I am. I've moved from Ohio to Louisiana to California, all in the span of, call it, my goodness, 3 years, 2 years, whatever it was, right? Because yeah. I left Ohio in January 2019 and went to Louisiana and then left in 2020, June of 2020, to go to California. So when I got there, you know, that job had been vacant for a little while. So there wasn't a real quote unquote training period. Office visits weren't a thing because it's COVID. Everything's shut down. I'm like, how in the hell am I supposed to meet people? How am I supposed to, you know, face-to-face appointments that I'm so used to in Ohio and Louisiana, the in-office, the dinners, the lunches, all these things that you do to build relationships, build people, that's all dead because of COVID. And so I just started posting on LinkedIn and it just, I guess I haven't looked back. So what the platform has done for me is offered me just connections, you know, to end all connections. I feel, you know, there's people that I'm not going to brag about my number because I don't even know what it is. But what I can tell you is that if I need to find somebody in my network, it's right there for me, right? And, you know, and this whole process with me and the journey I'm on, you know, it's been invaluable to reconnect with people that I've met along my journey and for new people to reach out to me. It's been very, you know, just a great format. But I think it's, you know, you get what you put into it. I do put things into it, you know, as far as some thought. It's funny because right before the show started here, I had a call with someone. I told that person, I said, you know, I don't buy it. People tell you should post every day, twice a day and do this and do this. I say, be yourself and be genuine and be transparent. Because if someone told me, you know, you use influencer, whatever words you want to use, people told me to post that I needed to post every day or twice a day, I'd tell them probably something I'm not allowed to say on this show. Just simply because for me, when I do put something out there, I want it to be true and genuine and not, oh, you haven't posted in 3 days, you better put something out there. I don't buy into that. So,
yeah, no, I totally agree. And you and I met some incredible folks, one of which is Alex Bayer. How did you meet Alex? How did that happen? How did that love matchmaking happen?
Yes. Yeah. So we met when I was at Jimbo's, you know, and I was a fan of his product. I bought the product and I lived at Jimbo's That's that work-life balance. when I worked at Jimbo's, we lived in Carlsbad and we shopped at a Vons that we could walk to. Just, you know, when I didn't buy things at Jimbo's, Vons was like literally half a mile from my house. Uh-huh. And I would buy his product there. And my understanding was, and he'd have to correct you on this, so I think Jimbo's carried it one time and there was some supply issues. He went through a spell where it wasn't available. They discontinued, never brought it back. So I think I had been on Mark's podcast and done that as a buyer for Jimbo's. And Alex reached out to me about doing his podcast. We started talking about the product, yada, yada. We brought it into Jimbo's and then everything's kind of grown from there. I mean, he was doing the 15 Minutes of Genius, which I did that show. And then he was periodically doing the Friday Vibe show, which was just periodically, he would just pop on and do it. It wasn't regular. Whereas 15 Minutes, I think he was doing it pretty regularly. We were just having a conversation one day and I'm like, maybe we should just do an every Friday thing. And, you know, all right, let's give it a whirl. And it is what it is. I mean, we signed up. It was first thing for Jimbo's. I had the Jimbo's banner in the background. It was Wade Yenny from Jimbo's. Jimbo loved it because it was promoting the business and whatnot. And it was the start of my, well, not the start, but early work day. It was 8 o'clock on Friday morning. So we'd log in and just chat about what was going on. And obviously it's morphed into this whole different thing that it is today that we can talk about if we want to. But yeah, it's been great.
Yeah. So Alex Bayer is a CP genius. And to understand what I'm just saying, I've interviewed Alex a while back. So check out that episode. But you and Alex started a podcast or a live on LinkedIn, which is a podcast as well, mm-hmm. called CPG Vibes, now called CPG Vibes. What was it previously?
Friday Vibes. And we switched it to CPG in case we wanted to do it on a different day. So, and we felt it was more relevant as far as what we were doing. So,
yep. So I love CPG Vibes, which, by the way, has become the number one CPG podcast ever in the history podcasts.
I don't know how many CPG podcasts are out there, but
it's the number one. Doesn't matter if there's only one. It's a number one, but there's more than one. And congrats on that. And by the way, for all of you Seven Hatters, I want you to pause this interview. We'll wait for you. Don't worry. Go check out the CPG Vibes on iTunes. And as Wade and Alex always start out with, leave them a 5-star review. I'm not kidding. Go do it. It's an amazing podcast. They speak with incredible folks, and we want to keep it number one. Okay.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
What did you learn as a leader, business person, entrepreneur? Is there anything that you've learned from all these shows that you've hosted with Alex that it just stands out, like something that's really Stan?
I think for me, and we've done different variations of the show. We've done, you know, guests, no guests, all these things. To me, it's kind of like my same philosophy for LinkedIn. You get what you put into it, you know, which I like to say we put in a lot, you know, as far as, you know, showing up and trying to share with the community. But I think the other thing is just being genuine and being, you know, nothing. It's truly, with the tagline is no script, just chat. If we log in 5 minutes before the show starts, that's a miracle. Usually it's like right when the show goes live, and it's what you see and what you hear is what's there. It's genuine. It's not, okay, we're going to talk about this or here's your line, here's my line. I mean, now we've got sponsors, and so there's a little bit of that creeping in because it has to, you know, when sponsors are involved, you know, you have to say certain things. But aside from that, we've tried to keep it to its core is what we started with is, hey, what's going on in this business that we love, you know, whether we're talking about brands or advice for emerging, you know, founders or what have you, and just really be an asset to the community as a whole, you know, because it is such a interesting, you know, coming from the conventional background in Ohio and Louisiana to natural organic specialty, it's just a different flow over on this side as far as the community aspect, the tight network and how it feels. And I think our purpose for that show is we've always wanted to be an asset, to bring value to people that are tuning in. And so what I've learned is just stick to your guts and be genuine regardless of, you know, of what you're doing, whether it's personal or professional. And more often than not, I think you're going to come out, you know, ahead of the game.
And I think consistency, you would agree, right? Because there were plenty of times probably in the beginning, you're like, who the hell's going to listen? And, you know, why am I putting in all this time? But over a good number of months, and I don't know how long it's actually been live.
Over 2 years now.
How much? 2 years?
Over 2 years.
Yeah. Over 2 years. Yeah. It's showing to be very successful. All right, last topic. I can speak with you forever. So last topic. The unknown. Mm-hmm. It can be daunting, especially when you're leaving a secure job to pursue new opportunities. I've been there, leaving the corporate world, the banking world, a six-figure salary to a completely unknown position. What inspired you and your recent decision to leave the buy world that you know so well and kind of leap into, I believe, really the unknown? You don't know what you're doing and where you're going to go, right? This is not like you had an idea, a brilliant idea, you're starting a new business. You basically said, honey, I'm going out to do something. I don't know what it is, but I'm leaving my salary job to do it. So tell me about that.
Yeah. So I would say a couple things. Once, and I started this, goodness, I probably started when I started working at Buehler's. I posted about this a while back, but for me, I've tried to, in my career, hold myself accountable for what I do and what steps I take. And so what I tried to do is probably predates Buehler's, actually. Every 2 or 3 years, I do kind of like a self-evaluation, I would call it. I mean, nothing, I don't have any chart or anything. It's more or less, okay, I'm going to look at the mirror. Where are you? Where do you want to be? Where are you going? You know, and just really ask myself those hard questions like, okay, are you happy? Are you being paid what you want to get paid? You know, is there advancement? All those things, right, that you consider when you're talking about things. And so I started that process. And for the most part, even though I was with Buehler's for 20 years, I still stuck to that philosophy coming out of the restaurant that I'd been in and then going to Buehler's. What I'd say about Buehler's, they kind of messed up my process because every 2 or 3 years they'd either give me another category or slightly change my role. You know, like I was the grocery dairy frozen buyer, and then they added the warehouse, and then I had this team member join. So there were enough changes that I really wasn't set in stone that I could look at that evaluation process, but I still stuck to it, right? And I did that in Louisiana. I did that in California, came to North Carolina, and I just finished 2 years here, and I've stuck to that. And so I think this was kind of the perfect storm for me, I think, as far as the thought process being up on 2 years, as well as some restructuring that was going on internally. It was a kind of a catalyst for me to say, okay, hey, wait, it's 2 years is up. Now this change is coming. You know, what do you want to do? You know, where are you? And I made the decision to leave. And, you know, it was a mutually agreed upon after I declined the role that was offered to me. And I worked nearly 2 month notice, you know, to help them transition into this next phase that they're going through. So leaving on very good terms and leaving a very, very capable team of outstanding people that are going to continue to just do great things. But for me, it was time to think more about, you know, things we've already talked about on, you know, the mental health aspect and what do I want to do? And so I think for me, what I've learned over the last 2 years is that I want to get back into more relationship driven aspect of some kind, you know, and not that I didn't have relationships at the Fresh Market, but it's more corporate, more, you know, just a different environment, which was absolutely beneficial for me and my development. But I think now it's like, okay, what's important to you? What do you want to do? And that's where I'm at.
Do you have any inkling to where you're going and what you're going to do? Or are you still?
So what I would tell you today on, am I allowed to say when we're recording this?
We're talking say whatever. Today is
April 30th. We're talking April 30th at 5:02 p.m. Eastern. I don't know what I'm doing. Really don't. And there's a part of that that's exhilarating. There's a part of that that's refreshing. There's a part of that that's terrifying. You know, you mentioned the security and aspects of, you know, that constant check that's coming in that goes away. But what I do know is that I'm confident in who I am and the relationships I've built over the years and my network. And I firmly believe everything happens for a reason. And I think that whatever lies ahead is going to be what I make of it. And it's up to me to make that successful, whatever that is. But if you're asking me now, I think more than likely it'll be something on the opposite side of the desk that I've been on in some fashion, whether that's sales or consulting or broker, something along those sides. I think that's my next likely venture, you know, something on that side, whether it's a brand, you know, the possibilities are endless. I think that's probably what lies ahead. And I think sticking to what I've said is I want to develop people. I want to develop relationships. I want to develop brands. And using that mentality and focus is kind of like, that's what I'm marching towards. And recognizing what's important and using my past experience to help guide the way.
I have a suspicion, an inkling that you're going to get a call one of these days and somebody's just going to pitch you some crazy idea and you're going to accept, not knowing if it's going to be successful or not. And it will be the next journey in your life. It always happens that way.
Could be.
Are you getting the support from your family and friends in terms of?
100%. Yeah. Yeah. My wife,
so important.
I tell people my wife walks on water. Now no one's ever challenged me to make her do that, but she is. She's just yin yang, you know, just the perfect partner for me as far as she balances me. You know, we truly are like, there's things I like that she doesn't and vice versa. We do them both because we are who we are, but she definitely helps balance me and keeps me focused. And, you know, we're each other's sounding boards when we need that guidance. And, you know, she's been more than supportive through this and encouraging absolutely every step of the way.
You are so blessed. I echo that because I am also blessed. My wife, Ala Karat, who I've started my first business with, and that business failed and we were in $1 million worth of debt and didn't know what was going to happen and we were going to lose our condo. And during that whole situation, I came up with the idea of Promash and I called her up and I told her about this idea. And I think 99.9% of the women out there would say, you're crazy. We just failed. Go get a job. And she said, I'm going to support you. And I know many folks don't have that support system at home. And that's probably one of the biggest blessings that I think any entrepreneur or any business person or human being can have, that support. That's why it's important to spend your time in building relationships, not just external mm-hmm. relationships, but internal relationships, because no business can be successful without the support of others. Right. Impossible. So it's why it's hat number three. Hat number exactly. one is mental health, having to do his health, fitness, and sleep. And hat number three is a relationship, because the fourth hat, entrepreneurial hat or the business hat, can never succeed without the first three. So it's a great reminder. So, Wade, where did time go? I love closing on my interviews with the following question. Who did you have to stop being, and who did you need to become to manifest your current success of where you are right now?
Who did I have to stop being? That's a difficult question. But what I would say is, you know, I liken it, you know, through the course of this, the last hour we've talked about this, you know, is, you know, and we didn't dive into some of the valleys and mountains along the way. And I've shared, you know, you just shared your story about being $1 million in debt and whatnot. My restaurant days, you know, when I had my own restaurant, it resulted in personal bankruptcy. And ultimately, about 10 years after that, in a divorce from my first wife. And so I think, you know, I had to stop being immature, you know, and really just kind of be, you know, present, you know, some of the things we've talked about. So when my wife, Renee, who I've been married to, this year will be 13 years since we've been together, I had to start, you know, being the person who you see, you know, and you allude to on LinkedIn, as far as, you know, that's genuine. You know, if I went back, you know, 25 years or what have you, if you met a younger version of me, that's the person I needed to stop being, is, you know, kind of reckless, careless with regards to money, with regards to focus on the career. And, you know, that's why I kind of haphazardly refer to that as my college education, right? Having that restaurant, having a bankruptcy, ultimately going through a divorce, all these different things, right? I mean, it's kind of like, you know, reckless college years, you know, frat parties and things like that. I did it kind of differently, but the parallels are there. So I had to stop being that person. I had to start focusing on what I'm talking about, is those relationships. And, you know, one of the other things, you know, we've talked about, you know, that I take great pride in is building teams and whatnot. And I'm so proud of the relationships I have in every stop along my journey, that there's not one stop along the way that there's not two, maybe five, 10 people that right now today I could call or text and ask for something, a question, a helping hand or something like that. And every stop along the way, someone would, I know, would pick up the phone and would do that. And so I think that's my focus going forward, is continuing with those relationships and understanding, again, whether internal or external, as you said, and I said earlier in my post, professional or personal, relationships are the key to everything. So
I think what makes you very special is your authenticity and your desire to help others. And I'm sure it stemmed at your restaurant, during your buyer journey, and now onto your next chapter. And I think that's what makes you so special and why I admire you and what you do every day. Is LinkedIn the best place for folks to contact you? Is that the main?
I think that's the easiest way, as opposed to, you know, I'm trying to learn, after how many years of having corporate email, my personal email, Gmail isn't quite as functional as I'd like it to be. So LinkedIn's probably the best way to do that. You know, I'm on there regularly, and if you message me, certainly I can get back to you. Although sometimes on the weekends and things like that, I try to take a little bit of a break, so that you know, that work life balance we talked about, or that mental health aspect, try not to be, you know, just chained to the LinkedIn piece all the time. But yeah, it's the easiest way.
I will leave a link in the show notes for you to get in touch with Wade. Wade, thank you so much for gracing us in the Seven Hats. I can't wait to follow your next journey and potentially have you back to discuss what happened.
Awesome. I appreciate it. Thanks for the time today. It's an honor being on here with you. And, you know, I have the utmost respect for you and what you do and what you, you know, you're doing for, you know, your hatters, as you call them. Kudos to you. You're a good soul.
Thank you. You too, yeah. My friend. You too. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Wade. Let's end today with a show segment that I refer to as What Can We Hang Our Hat On? And here is my takeaway. As we reflect on Wade's journey throughout the CPG industry, a powerful lesson stands out. One that resonates deeply in today's ever-evolving market landscape. Wade's story teaches us the importance of adaptability and relationship building in the CPG world, where competition is fierce and shelf space is limited. His experience highlights a crucial reality. It's not just about getting your products on the shelf, but about maintaining that position through genuine connection and an unwavering commitment to quality and customer needs. But let's not stop there. Let's bring this lesson into a broader context. Recently, we've seen major shifts in consumer behavior, especially post-pandemic, with an increased emphasis on quality, sustainability, and transparency. Brands are no longer just products. They represent values and lifestyles, and the CPG landscape is being reshaped by consumers who demand more than just convenience. They seek purpose and authenticity. Waite's journey underscores the need for brands to stay true to their core values while being flexible enough to navigate the changing tides. This delicate balance can lead to long-term success. Whether you're an entrepreneur, a leader, or someone striving to make a difference, this lesson is invaluable. Moreover, Waite's emphasis on mental health in high-pressure roles reminds us that success isn't just about professional achievements. Taking care of your well-being, setting boundaries, and finding time for self-care are essential for sustainable success. In an era where burnout is all too common, prioritizing mental health can be the key differentiator. So as we bid farewell today, let's carry forward Waite's insights. Embrace adaptability, foster genuine relationships, stay true to your values, and prioritize your mental well-being. These are the pillars that can help us navigate not only the CPG industry, but any challenging landscape we face. I want to thank Waite once again for sharing his journey and wisdom with us. And until next time, if you found this episode helpful, please hit that subscribe button and share the value you receive with other entrepreneurs out there so that we can attract even more high-quality people into our 7 Hats community. For now, I will bid you farewell and success on your journey. And until next time, my name is Yuval Selik, and I tip my hat to you.